This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
My planet Arrakis is so beautiful when the sun is low. Rolling over the sands, you can see spice in the air.
Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at everybody's favorite month-based saga, Dune. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the science that this movie brings up, including big desert worm boys, adaptations for desert life in general, and non-Newtonian fluids. As always, it'll be broken up into a few different segments. You can have time codes below, so skip ahead if you really just wanted to hear about non-Newtonian fluids today. If you woke up this morning and you just had a raging hard-on for non-Newtonian fluids, you go to that section. You go to it as fast as you can.
Yeah. And we know you do.
I do every morning.
This is true.
That's for sure.
But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses alongside co-host Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Beringen University of the Niger. Alongside Adam is the Baroness,
a ladyship to be young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup.
It's Vinnie Jones.
He's more refined Cockney. Yeah, too deep. Yeah,
It was like thuggish.
Ray Winston is who I was going for.
Go. Yeah.
Alongside the three of us is Dave, a vet and our movie physiologist. Who's got news? Wer hat Nachrichten? Wem haben die Hette?
So the rare penis plant has bloomed for the first time in 25 years.
Take that, feminism.
Can we get the scientific name for this thing?
It is the... oh, God. Amorphophallus decus sylvae. Did I say it right?
Amorphophallus. Yeah.
Amorphophallus decus sylvae.
Yeah, I think amorphous means the shape of, and then phallus. So the name basically means shape of a dick.
Shape of a dick.
I do like the image that Libby sent all of us that has a group of women taking pictures of it and standing around laughing at it.
Made that plant feel real good about itself.
They just can't believe the girthiness of the plant.
So thick. It's a turgid plant.
On the other side of the, let's say, I don't know if I can say gender spectrum here. There were two female Californian condors this week who, one of them, they reproduce using, fuck's sake.
Asexually.
Adam, what's the word?
Parthenogenesis.
And the conservation community breathed a deep sigh of relief before screaming out, why the fuck didn't you do this 10 years ago when there were 10 of you left in the wild?
Uh-huh. Two comments on that. One, the funny thing I saw was the headline recording, quote, virgin births, which is a nice way of anthropomorphizing these rare birds.
Mm-hmm.
Two, this
the Jesus condors.
Yeah, exactly. This is, two, a great example of an adaptation is not always going to come along when it's necessary, and it's a matter of the proper mutation showing up at the proper time to respond to the specific selection pressure. So while it would have been great to have the ability to reproduce parthenogenetically without, in the past, when there's only 10 of them left, 10 of those 10 individuals probably did not have the ability, and maybe it popped up recently or it was expressed recently because of inbreeding, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the inbreeding would have still been a problem even if they had used parthenogenesis to reproduce. There we go, I said it right. It's also worth noting this isn't the first time it's happened amongst birds. Turkeys have been doing this for a long time, apparently.
Komodo dragons can do it too. Another reptile. Before we move on from the news, I want to bring up one more point. Sam, I don't know if you've been following this, but there's been another slew of retractions from another ecologist who might have been faking his data.
Oh, shit.
Oh, who is it this time?
Denon Start. A guy whose papers I've cited a few times, so I think I need to go back and take those out of some manuscripts I've submitted.
Yikes.
So you're saying he may need to restart writing some of his papers?
No, start, Sam. His name is Start. Denon Start, not Restart. So.
But is Dennis become a menace?
Oh, touche.
Dave, kill me.
You're just being cynical.
No, it's just the principle. Someone, won't you make it stop?
All right, so moving on, we covered the newest version of Dune this week. And Dune is about a young interplanetary Victorian boy, Paul Atreides, of the noble house Atreides. He is forced alongside his father and concubine mother to rule over a stolen fiefdom on a desert planet of Arrakis that is rich with a valuable hallucinogenic spice that is actually worm poop that no one seems to talk about. This fiefdom was stolen from a brutish, bald noble family of House Harkonnen, and they ain't happy about that. That'll come into play more later. Paul is troubled by his persistent wet dreams of a strange desert chick he has yet to meet. His mother, who, by the way, is a space witch, is concerned but also kind of happy about these dreams, as it might mean that her son is the Kwisatz Haderach, aka the Supreme Space Witch. There's a guy named Duncan Idaho who really isn't that important in this movie, but he might be in the future, so he has a way bigger part than he should. The jilted Harkonnens plot and execute the revenge for the stolen kingdom. And when I say execute, I mean they kill Paul's dad. And they try to kill him and his mom, but they make their witchy escape into the desert and live with the desert people called the Fremen. There's also giant sandworms and a fun new fall recipe to make coffee.
I appreciate you used the word jilted.
Okay, so this movie was visually brilliant. Like, I am on and off with Denis Villeneuve. I love Prisoners, and I love Arrival, and I hate Blade Runner 2049, and I watched Enemy on Friday, and I fucking hate it. So I find him really hit and miss. This, for me, wasn't as good as Arrival and Prisoners, but it was pretty close. I thought he did an amazing job of packing all this lore into one film so that it was understandable. I have watched the 1984 film, or at least 1980s film, at least the first half of it. I had no idea what was going on. I found it completely undecipherable. It was weird and gross. This film, I understood kind of everything. I thought the expo was done much more smoothly. And whilst there was an aspect of it that I didn't like, that I'll get into it later, I thought the take on the trope of, you know, this one person who's going to save everyone, the twist on that of a group of people trying to manufacture this person as opposed to find them and wait for them and, you know, hope for them to come along. I thought the manufacture of that messiah figure was an interesting take on what has become a fairly boring trope at this point in films, I feel.
I think, much like Sam, I think this movie was visually spectacular. It looked great. I enjoyed the sound design. I wish I had seen it in the theater, but I watched it at home. COVID situation's a little difficult here in Israel right now, and very expensive.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed the look of everything. I feel like for the most part, it kind of looked how I imagined it in my head. And even if it was different, it still worked in a way that I think fit with the presentation in the book, which I really appreciated. And I have read the book, the first two at least. So having all of this boiled down and kind of cut apart in a way was very effective, I think. It really boiled it down to what you needed to know from this enormous, crazy backstory. And it was very effective in a comparatively short movie for the amount of lore it had to work with. I liked it a lot.
Not to sound repetitive, but I think for me, the best part of this movie was the visuals. It's how I imagined it looked when I was reading it. I think they did a really good job of creating... It's hard, I think, in sci-fi movies to create things that look interplanetary while using film locations on Earth. I think, you know, if you watch any of the old Star Treks, it's just like, and there's William Shatner in California, you know, but he's like supposed to be on some foreign planet. So I do understand that they use a lot of visual effects, but I think for filming locations and things like that, it just felt like I was watching another planet, you know. I think they did a really good job with that.
I fucking love this movie. I had such a good time. I fucking love these books, and I will say that, just so I can step away from, I agree with all the points you guys made. But one thing that I felt they did a really good job on and I really appreciated was the feeling of despair when Atreides is getting wiped out. Like, they do such a good job of just feeling this, like, awful, like, the creatures are coming in from all sides. When the Sardaukar, like, they come in from the top and they start, like, killing the Atreides on the stairs. And you just, there was this overwhelming fear of, like, fuck, this is awful. Your entire world is burning. You're losing everything and there's nothing you can do. You're just being slaughtered in the progress or in the process. Like, there's no one's going to save you. There's no good guy that comes out of nowhere. And it's such a powerful bit in the book. And I remember the first time reading that and just being like, no, you're killing off everybody I liked. What are you doing? And it just, they did such a good job with that.
One last random thing that I want to throw in is that I really fucking hate what we've done nowadays with like action icons, that they have to just like eat nothing like a month and a half before any role and get ridiculously shredded. And it was just nice to see Jason Momoa like, just, you know, just looking like a normal, healthy 6'5" man. It made me happy to see him just having a laugh and a smile and not having to starve himself for months before this role.
Yeah, if anybody was shredded, it was Duke Leto naked in that chair at the end. Oscar Isaac just giving the audience what they want.
God damn Oscar Isaacs.
Definitely didn't pause just, that scene. Why do you ask?
No, me either. Yeah. Only that glorious fucking beard he was rocking the entire time.
I mean, I've never seen a man rock a naked, semi-conscious slouch.
Yeah, all right, Sam, what didn't you like?
Yeah, so, and look, this is no fault of the film itself, but this trope of the one, the kind of the messiah figure who's come along to save everyone. At this point, and I do realize that this was, you know, one of the forerunners to this whole trope, but at this point in 2021, we have seen this so many times before. That, I felt dragged a bit. I think everyone has this problem. It doesn't end. Lord of the Rings is a three-parter. They shot it all at once. But every one of those films, it has an ending. Yeah. Like, of course there's more that's going to happen afterwards. We know that. But this film ends what feels like in the middle. And I didn't like that at all. And lastly, the reactions to this movie, to any kind of criticism of it, have been grotesque. I would compare it to Joker, for instance. Like, if I'd just seen Joker by itself, independent of all the reactions to it, I think I would have enjoyed it a lot more than I actually did. Because, you know, people have criticized this movie, and they've had just waves of people coming out saying, oh, yeah. Well, you just don't understand it because you haven't read the books. This is more like artistry. It's not like a Marvel Quipfield extravaganza, you fucking tourist. Go and do some knowledge. It's like, oh, come on. This is still, like, a pop culture centerpiece. It looks amazing, but get off your fucking high horses.
Yeah.
And that kind of dragged it down and told me beforehand as well.
That's fair. I think for me, although they did do a really good job of condensing this massive work of fiction into a single, well, one the first part of a, and making that first part a 2.5 hour movie, nothing really happened. It's just 2.5 hours of build up with a brief little fight there where the Atreides are getting wiped out and Dave is really sad. But then it's just over and there's no like transition. There's no real climax. There's no real ending. It's just, all right, see you in 3 years, I guess. And I think that for me really took my, it really took a lot of enjoyment away from this movie. Not that I dislike it by any means. It's just like, okay, I guess it's over now.
Yeah. Would you have felt differently if they had shot this all at once and you knew there was a second part coming in like a year or 8 months?
I don't think so, because I'm assuming there's going to be a second part coming regardless, just because it will probably do well enough slash...
It's already greenlit.
I think there might be... Yeah, it's okay. It's already been greenlit. Like, it's going to happen. It's just a matter of, like you said about Lord of the Rings, you can break things up and still have a, quote, traditional movie structure, but this just felt like... I think it's... was it Nicki Minaj's Anaconda song where she takes the beat from Baby Got Back and just builds and builds and builds, but it never drops? It just felt like that. It's like, okay, 3 years from now, I guess, fuck, I guess we can have this beat drop finally, fuck.
Yeah,
fair enough.
It's interesting. I feel the opposite.
Interesting.
I felt like this movie did not have the tension and the build up that the books have. I felt if they had taken, how do you say his last name? Villeneuve,
I think, yeah.
If he had taken about, I could have done with about 10 minutes less of Zendaya and Timothy Chalamet middle distance staring. And if I could have taken those 10 minutes and put That's it into fair. Exposition, I would have been so much more happy. I think it was just missing a lot of the explanation that it needed to have that tension of this political situation. It felt very cram-packed story-wise. This was my big complaint with the Henry Cavill Superman movie. It was just like they tried to fit so much into the movie that it just felt like I was watching a scrapbook of a story. And that's what this felt like to me. It was like, I understood it and I understood the plot. I definitely understood it more because I read the book. But I think that if I had not read the book, it just would have felt so briefly touched on that I wouldn't have been as absorbed into the world as I could be, as the books make you. And I just felt like it was lacking that exposition, that necessary story time and the necessary build into the final betrayal and Atreides' death. And I think, to Sam's point, I agree. I think that they should have ended on the climax of Leto being killed and Paul and Jessica making their escape into the desert. And then the next movie should have started off with the Jameis fight.
Mm-hmm. Definitely agree in terms of the drag. My criticism more has to do with, I felt there was a wasted opportunity with Dr. Yue. So that was always my greatest point of conflict in the books, was understanding how the doctor could just turn on and betray the entire family of like the Atreides, just knowing that they have his wife. I mean, there's a lot that you can do to say like, oh yeah, your wife's been taken hostage. You're going to try to get her. But he dropped a little bit of a line in the movie where he said that he needs to free her because she is constantly getting torn apart and put back together. And I felt that would have been a way better point if they just stretched that or added in another comment of him talking about his wife to make it more believable for him to shut down the shields and betray everyone that he cares about and break his imperial conditioning. The idea that every moment you waste, someone that you love is being continuously tortured, and you know that if you kill yourself or die or fail, that the Harkonnen are so dickish, they're just going to keep torturing her forever.
In the book, it implies too that partially why he betrays them is because he sees it as the only way out. Like, he knows that they're going to be betrayed anyways, so he's like, I might as well be the one to do it and be in control of the betrayal, so they
and
have
he wants
a
to try and kill the Baron.
Paul escapes.
Yeah, and he knows it's his only one shot to try and get the Baron with the tooth. But it's always been a less believable, and I did feel like the movie added something, and I was like, oh, if you could have just stretched that. And I know they cut scenes with him talking about his wife out of the movie, and I would have just liked a little bit more to make that betrayal more believable.
Yeah, but we needed all those scenes of Timothy Chalamet thinking about Zendaya just staring back.
Stellan Skarsgård coming out of a gross, bubbly bath.
We needed.
I really loved that.
I fucking love that. I thought Stellan Skarsgård was amazing.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Oh, he's fantastic. All of his scenes are so gross and like really catching your imagination.
It's because it's so much less visceral than the 1980s version, but there's something about Skarsgård's performance which is way more unsettling than the 1980s thing, I felt.
So a little bit of trivia is that the 2021 movie took more than 2,000 visual effects shots, and they created it using a sand screen rather than a green screen to match the establishing desert shots.
Interesting.
This is kind of interesting new way of doing it. The brown screen was more helpful in, like, I think, matching the color palettes.
Sam, grow up, please.
Yeah.
Was it really called a brown screen?
Yeah.
That sounds horrible. They should have just said sand screen.
Yeah. Poop.
Poop suits.
So the author, Frank Herbert, was inspired to write Dune by the Oregon Dunes in Florence, Oregon. He described them as moving dunes that could swallow whole cities, lakes, rivers, and highways.
Huh. Cool.
Cool.
Never been to Oregon, but that sounds cool.
And then, I was going to point this out, you know, Sam was talking about the trope of having the one and how many plays and movies and books have captured on that, and he definitely did. So his inspiration was Arthurian legends.
Okay.
So, like King Arthur, the boy that could save the kingdom.
Pull a large sword out of a rock.
Mm-hmm.
Large worm out of the dune.
Or get a watery tart thrown at him from a... What's the line?
Some watery tart handing out hardware.
That is why I'm your king. But you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you. Shut up!
So, before we start looking at the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at BigDogFishboy. Adam is at HarsikAdam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematicaanimalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in Cinematica Animalia and you'll find us. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to find out some more about the less movie-related ecology that Adam, I, and a huge team of international writers write about, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. And as always, if you enjoy the podcast, tell a friend, leave us a rating, you can do it in-app, it really helps. Suggest a movie. We're always on the lookout for more. Recommend that show. So, we're going to talk a lot about the Shai-Hulud.
Actual cannibal Shai-Hulud.
Yes. Actual cannibal Shai-Hulud.
Dave or Adam, does one of you want to give us a quick run-through of what they are? Because we don't really see much of it in the film.
So, the sandworms are the native life form of the planet Arrakis. They're huge. So in the books, basically they're citing specimens up to 450 meters long spotted by observers. I found an interesting comparison online that was discussing that the largest earth animal, so the blue whale, being 33 meters, which would be only
ever lived,
which will be only 7% of the total length that would be associated with these sandworms. They've obviously got those large, thick plated skin and they move around on the sands, attacking anything that creates sufficient vibration, and we'll sort of talk about that a little bit later today. The giant scales that they're covered in are each a few feet in size, and the Fremen, the native population, has the ability to actually peel those scales back, which creates irritation for the worm and causes the worm to sort of rise to the top of where that irritating scale is, and then allows the Fremen to ride on top of these worms.
So that's how that scene that we see at the end of the film is working.
So they steer them.
Yeah, and they won't dive when it's exposed, and you ride them up until they're like exhausted. The Fremen have rules about how long you can ride them before you like shut the scale and hop off, and then the worm like dives.
And the but about their length, the largest specimen mentioned in the book is being about over a league long, so 1.5 miles or 2.4 kilometers in length.
Yeah, so
a single animal.
They find way longer sandworms eventually.
Okay.
Perfect. So in the books, their diet consists of sand and other inorganic compounds from the dry components of Arrakis crust, and they also sift through for sand plankton for nourishment. They are also responsible for most of the oxygen production on Arrakis. And when exposed to water, it is absolutely fatal to them, with small doses causing a chain reaction that leads to them becoming biologically unstable and violently dying, which will become a big point in the next book. Now, their life cycle is complicated as fuck, and so this will be where Adam steps in, because I still don't fully understand it.
And neither do I. But the sand plankton that Dave mentioned earlier are, to the best of my understanding, the earliest stage of the life cycle of these sandworms. So they are small, for lack of a better term, plankton, which are, you know, very small organisms in the ocean, but in this case they are in a desert environment in the sand. On Arrakis, on Dune, the desert planet, as I repeat like 8 times at the beginning of the book if you've ever listened to it or read it, it is basically oceans of sand, so hundreds of meters deep of just sand. There's not like a hard surface of bedrock underneath the sand that we don't really see, except for those rocks that they hide on to get away from the worms. And these plankton move through the sand, and they are then fed upon by the large sandworms, the Shai Hulud, the makers. And these sand plankton can eventually grow into what's called a sand trout, which is about a couple feet long, you know, 1 or 2 meters in length. And these are the next stage, which are the ones that are actually involved in the making of the spice melange. They excrete a product that is a kind of a pre-spice material, substance of some kind, which builds up with gases over time to form a pre-spice mass. This is not something we see in the movie, but in the book, these pre-spice masses are basically these gigantic bubbles of gas under the surface of the sand that are incredibly dangerous because they will eventually explode, causing, you know, a lot of damage to the sand around them and billowing up all of the spice onto the surface of the planet itself, which is how you get these spice fields that the sand crawlers then come along to mine and then usually get attacked by sandworms. So these sand trout, some of them will eventually get large enough to become sandworms themselves, growing to this massive, massive size. So that is the life cycle. So our actual cannibal Shai Hulud joke is actually true because it seems that all these things do is make more of themselves and feed on all the other ones. They don't seem to be feeding on anything else on this planet, except by happenstance.
Yeah, and in fairness, this does happen in nature every now and then. When you get one system when there's... So, for instance, the system I like to bring up is Arctic char. Up in the northern regions of the planet, when there's no other fish in a lake, you'll often get larger Arctic char feeding on smaller ones constantly. And you eventually develop two types of Arctic char. One's that kind of what we call a dwarf morph that just feeds on insects and other larvae. And then the larger Arctic char, which feed on the smaller ones. So that's not completely without precedent, this sort of system. Normally doesn't happen through sand.
Right, and you can't have a closed loop. Yeah. There still has to be something bringing in new energy, new nutrients, especially if we're shipping a shit ton of the melange off the planet. As they talk about, like, they fill these things up and then they send them out. You know, the spice must flow, a phrase that was never said in the movie, to my great disappointment.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing about these, I thought, was that the teeth in this movie, they remind me a lot of baleen.
Yes.
You get on whales.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know what baleen is, essentially they're specialized teeth that have evolved to form these kind of brush-like filaments. And what whales will do is that they'll suck massive amounts of water and fish into their mouths. They'll clamp the baleen shut, and then they will push all that water out through the baleen, and all the solids will get left inside. For the life of me, I cannot figure out how that would work with sand. Unless the sand is incredibly fine, I guess that would help.
Which it seems to be, at least for some of it.
Yeah, so if the sand is incredibly fine, and they're just sucking in massive amounts of sand into their jaws and then blasting all the sand out at once, I guess that would help them feed?
Potentially.
If they've got a secondary track for it. If they're pulling in and they're filtering and somehow these teeth are moving it into a primary gastrointestinal system and the rest of the sand is just kind of sifting through some sort of internal digestive tract that isn't absorbing, it's just moving sand from one side to the other.
Okay.
It might also just help with feeding.
You said they feed on sand, right?
Right. If there was actually any nutrients to get from silica, and if there were any organisms that could organize and use that. I mean, obviously, this is taking place on a different planet, different physics, different rules. But before the podcast, even Adam and I were talking, you need water. Like, the big consensus from most biologists, ecologists, that's why, like, water on Mars excited people so much. Like, life seems to, as far as we understand it, that seems to be a basic requirement.
And it is odd that you have all these other organisms on this planet that have, as we see, and we'll talk a little bit about later, such well-developed mechanisms for surviving in a place without water. And then they've just gone the other direction with the Shai Hulud and been like, if they come in contact with water, they explode into a geyser of blood or something like that. It's like, it's very at odds with the rest of the life on Dune. Or Arrakis.
Desert planet.
Or Dune.
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 Do you not say Dune, by the way?
Dune.
Dune.
Dune. Okay, you do say Dune.
Dune. Yeah.
Like, Dune, where's my car?
I say, dude, where's my car?
In terms of these guys being a filter feeder, like what Sam is describing, I think that makes total sense. I do think that there's probably some sort of secondary species, something that has photosynthetic qualities, like a sand plankton works for me, that these guys are used to filter feeding out of the sand in large quantities and basically getting that substance. I think likely the sand plankton are moving, and they're probably moving in swarms large enough underneath the sand that they trigger a movement sensor, which is why these worms so aggressively go towards movement. I think that probably the sand plankton really aren't creating that much of a movement or shift. These big worms have gotten really good at sensing those small vibrations. And so they're just showing up to fuck anything up. And I don't imagine that eating a spice harvester is going to be great for their digestion. But again, if they have some sort of internal system where they're just the sand they swallow is just moving through them or out a second pore, it may not do that much trouble to them.
It could be that they just haven't adapted to realize that the sand harvesters are very, very poor sources of food. Yeah. I mean, it took organisms in Australia. I mean, there's still organisms in Australia who haven't figured out that you shouldn't eat cane toads.
Agreed. And I mean, I'm more getting at, we don't see any like worms suffering serious side effects of this. Like we don't see, I mean,
we never hear about it.
Right. We don't see them dying or getting gastrointestinal obstructions or vomiting up sand crawler or the spice harvesters in various locations.
It's like a tiger shark. Those things have been known to eat everything. I remember having a book when I was a kid of like of things they found in shark stomachs. Like that was a segment of it. And I wanted to say they pulled an entire set of medieval plate armor out of a tiger shark stomach because they fallen off a boat and didn't eat it.
Yep.
It's like, what the fuck are you doing?
Like the goats of the ocean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
goats will eat fucking anything. So I think these, the shy halud are similar. But Dave, your comment about the silica not being very handy made me think that maybe on Arrakis there is some silica-based organism that is blending in with or living amongst the sand that these that the shy halud are then eating, because that's always something that's brought up in sci-fi or in speculative science about another form of life, because we are, like everything on our planet, carbon-based, because as far as the how the molecular structure of carbon works is you have four attachment points around a carbon molecule, which is why it's really good to build in, you know, structures around carbon. Silica is similar, and it's a similar, like, it's one row down in the same column on the periodic table. So, like carbon, silica is a really good building block for life. So, theoretically, you could have a silica-based organism. We just haven't really seen it yet. So, maybe that's what's happening on Dune.
And we talked earlier in the season about diatoms. Diatoms, whatever. About diatoms, I mean, you could just have raging populations of diatoms here. They may have evolved.
They're silica-based.
Yeah.
I definitely, don't have any concerns. I think it is going to have photosynthetic qualities with all the sun. It's going to have to be pulling energy into the planet. That, or at least getting its energy off the heat that's generated from the sand. Right? You can't have a closed system in any network. Now, the more interesting point I wanted to talk with you guys about here. So the sandworms, it's a cool idea in the books that they're responsible for oxygen production on Arrakis. I don't know if I buy that. They're super duper large, but I wonder if it doesn't make more sense that the sand plankton or whatever the organism is in the sand is going to be the one sort of producing the oxygen, and our sandworms are going to be the ones breaking it down. Does that make more sense?
I mean, it's worrying if you just have one type of organism producing all of the oxygen. I mean, we talk about how, you know, the Amazon are the lungs of the earth, but massive amounts of the planet's photosynthesis are carried out by algae, which kind of, you know, doesn't get enough doesn't get enough credit.
So my colleagues back at during my PhD at the University of Arkansas, they worked in the diatom lab, and their common saying was, for every third breath you take, thank a diatom, because diatoms produce 30% of the oxygen on our planet.
Yep.
Yeah. So potentially there's just a really diverse a really biodiverse group of diatoms on the planet that are producing the oxygen. I think it's much more likely than the megafauna producing it. Because, I mean, if you do have megafauna producing it, they're going to go through population cycles. Drops, dives, peaks, troughs. Then you're going to have a planet whose atmosphere has wildly fluctuating oxygen content, which doesn't really make for a good planet to create.
Now, this does lead into the best point, though. Which means that the ecologist in this does not seem like an idiot. So she definitely knows what's going on, but she's just decided the other fuckwits that show up on the planet and leave don't give a shit about all this. And she's like, there's just giant worms, guys. It's worms. All right, they make the oxygen. Like, just leave me the fuck alone.
You got to deal with it. You don't want to deal with it? Oh, well, I guess you'll have to go home.
I guess I'll do it.
Too bad.
I did like the respect that the, you know, planet's chief ecologist.
The imperial ecologist.
It was just nice to hear the word ecologist in a movie.
One of the only times I've ever heard it.
So a little bit of, I didn't put it in the trivia section, but I saw that Frank Herbert actually dedicated this book in part to all dry land ecologists.
Oh, cool.
That's so cool.
He put that in his dedication. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Because the drylands is a term that doesn't really get brought up that much. Drylands is arid, semi-arid, and dry subhuman areas, which make up 46% of the global land area and a home of 3 billion people. So they're very, very important ecosystems.
I think I live in one of those areas now.
Yeah, I think you do. I think you might, yeah.
It's less than 150 millimeters of water a year. We had a little bit of rain today, but it was for literally 5 minutes, and it was just like drops. You know those drops when it like starts to rain? That's what this entire rain was.
Yeah, the wet season, as they call it in Israel.
Oh, that's coming. Apparently it rains. I'm looking forward to it. I do not mind the
rain sometimes. Our next section was just moving through general desert adaptation.
So we see a really interesting one. But I was giving Adam shit about this before the podcast because he said it was a kangaroo rat, because we do see an image of what looks like a kangaroo rat beforehand, and I wrote down, it's a jiboa, you fucking moron.
In all caps.
Yes, he did.
In all caps, yeah. J-E-R-B-O-A. But I'm looking through my notes here that I took just after the movie, and the first thing I wrote was, I like the kangaroo rats. So, you know.
It's a jiboa, you fucking idiot.
And as we were discussing before the podcast,
that note to yourself.
This is the reason why the planet has only one ecologist on it, because clearly, even on a podcast, you can't have two because they fight constantly.
I have seen ecologists going at each other's fucking throats for the most like benign, banal little like differences in terminology that they disagree on. It is bonkers.
It really is. I think what happened was another planetary ecologist came along and was like, I think there's sand snakes, and Leah Kynes killed them.
I was about to say, yeah, she's Fremen, so she challenged them to the fight.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or just threw them into a sand snake's mouth. Like, find out yourself, motherfucker. What do you think of the internet? A sand snake.
I want to say just like a brief thing from the book that Libby bring up the knife. I really appreciate it and wish they had been able to put it in the movie, because the image of this in my head was always so funny to me. In the knife fight in the book, Jessica tries using her weirding ways. She tries using the voice on Jameis to make him stop fighting. She's like, there's no point in this. I don't want you to kill my son. And they're like, the Fremen are used to this kind of thing. They've been kind of, as they say in the movie, conditioned for the arrival of the Bene Gesserit. So they know that there are these weirding women out there. And he's basically like, she's trying to do shit to me. And he like, they say that he puts his fist to his head and says, I invoke the silence upon her. So like, if you talk, he's going to fucking kill you. Which I thought was fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The Benetton Jeffersons.
The Benny Jefferson airplanes.
The Blessed Jesuits.
Oh, no.
The Benefajetsons.
Benefajetsons.
I had a big list of these.
Of course you did.
Benetton Jesmans. The Beneficent Jezebels. Anyway. But I did love that scene with the jiboa or kangaroo rat or whatever you want to call it, where it takes the moisture from its ears. Because a lot of desert species have evolved the ability to do that, to collect collect the moisture that develops in their noses, in other orifices, and, you know, retain that moisture.
Horned toads.
Species have, I mean, they have to deal with this sort of shit on a daily basis. One of the worst things about these dry lands for a lot of the species that live in them is many species will base when they reproduce or when they go into feeding frenzies on seasonality. But when you're living in these areas, you don't have that option a lot of the time. You don't know when the next big rain is going to happen at all. So, you know, life is really unpredictable.
Very much so.
One of my favorite adaptations to this is urine concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to retain as much water as possible, right? I looked into this way more than I should have while I was doing research. So normal urine osmolality is just the concentration of solute or salt per water, right? The normal urine osmolality for a human is about 500 to 800 milliliters of osmol, fucking solute, whatever, per kilo for a human, right? It's about 10 to 15 times that for a mammal living out in the in the desert.
So they're just pissing table salt?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, any time that you've been to the toilet and you thought, wow, my pee really stinks today, that times like 10 every time they have to take a whiz.
Super potent.
Yeah. Just real nasty. Asparagus all day, every day.
I've had so many of these things. Not kidding. I may wet my pants. Where's the bathroom?
Holy shit. Dude, this is like Shrek's piss.
Yeah, I think that in relation to water retention, kind of what we see the Jiboa, I'm going to call it a kangaroo rat because that's what they are in the book, and it's very key to Paul's eventual alter ego and what we named our car.
Frank Herbert, you're a fucking idiot. It's a Jiboa.
He's a genius, Sam. You just don't get it. It's art.
Adam.
It's art.
Adam,
it's
can art. You please put your fist to your head right now and invoke the silence?
I invoke the silence.
I was about to say, Sam, you would have gotten it if you would have read the book.
But yeah, so we see the small mammal collect all of the sweat and or dew on its fur and start drinking it. And from watching many wonderful nature documentaries, we know that a lot of these desert animals will kind of become active towards dawn, stand stationary on the top of a dune, collect all this moisture as it condenses when the temperatures start to change, and then slurp it up as quick as they can because they're just taking water basically from the air to drink because there's nothing else they're going to be able to get, and that might be their one chance to get some water during the day.
There's lots of desert amphibians who will just like let dew condense on their bodies and like drink by, you know, imbibing it through their pores. There's some species of animal that like desert species that you will give them water and they won't know what to do with it. You have to sprinkle it on them to hydrate them. Otherwise they're just like, I don't know what to do with water. I've never drunk anything in my life.
Exactly.
Top class whiskey for me, please.
Yeah, actually the research I do now is working with gerbils as our host animals, which are a desert species. And we don't give them water like on a day-to-day basis. We give them millet, which are, you know, these little seeds, and they eat it, and their body basically makes this what's called metabolic water from that, and that's what they sustain themselves off of. So we give them alfalfa as a treat, and they can get a bit of moisture from that, but they don't need water to survive because they don't get it normally. So they've evolved to kind of get around that need through another alternative pathway.
Well, yeah, they need water to survive. They just don't need to drink water.
They don't need liquid water to survive, I should say.
And I like the idea with the sandworms of a species that has adapted to have almost zero moisture content and to get it from other places so that maybe if it does come across water, it's just like it's an overload. It fucks up.
It overdoses, yeah.
Because you find that with... Yeah, you find that with plants a lot. They'll adapt for areas that, you know, there's just no water or there's no phosphorus or nitrogen in the soil or whatever. And you'll try and plant them in an area that's really, you know, heavy in nitrogen or phosphorus or whatever the limiting factor is. And they'll just die because they can't use it.
Yeah, there was... I used to be in the Boy Scouts and we went to a 1 week trip on a place called Sea Base, which is an island in the Florida Keys. And they recommend, like, hey, we're in the Keys. It's very hot and humid. You're going to be losing a lot of water. You need to drink a lot of water during the day to stay hydrated and healthy. One woman took this way too literally and drank 5 gallons or about 20 liters in an hour.
Jesus.
And she had to be flown to the hospital because her cells were exploding from the amount of water she had in her body. She basically gave herself water poisoning.
It can swell your brain.
It's really dangerous.
Yeah, you can drink too much water.
Not if you're a camel. Which is another adaptation we need to get into as far as... look at that perfect segue. Whenever if you're adapted to desert life, as we've been talking about, and as you see from the movie, there's fucking nothing out there. You don't get a chance to eat very often, you don't get a chance to drink very often, so you need to be adapted to these long periods without any kind of resources. So things like camels can drink an absolutely enormous amount of water whenever they come across it and just kind of... be good for a very long time. Their body is effective at kind of processing that, maintaining a lot of their food as fat in their hump, which they can kind of then sustain themselves off of over time. They don't have water in their hump. That's a cartoon thing. But
they can convert the fat that's in their hump into water.
Yeah, probably in a similar process to what the gerbils do as far as that metabolic water.
I remember when I learned for the first time that camels' humps, you know, as they lose fat and water, they go flaccid. And I did not know that. And so I just watched a video of a guy just like jiggling the loose camel hump. And it blew my mind.
Did it look like a scrotum? I'm imagining a scrotum.
Sure. Never seen one. I don't know.
You're married, though.
I just close my eyes every time.
Me too.
Okay, well, one more thing that we should probably point out is so Allen's rule. Which is this really cool rule that says, as species get closer to the desert, further away from the colder extremes of the planet, you get larger appendages. So, for instance, and you see that in the Jaboa, they have massive ears, which are really good for heat loss. Heat gets moved off them really, really quickly. The veins are often very close to the surface. And you even see this within the same species. So some of the species that have moved out to Australia, that have been brought to Australia, like the European rabbits, European hares, they have been here for a while, and they now have much larger ears than their conspecifics, than members of the same species who are still in Europe. And this is the same. You look at different fox species as you get closer to the equator and further away from the poles, right? Mm-hmm. Arctic foxes, tiny little fucking ears. Fennec foxes. Massive, enormous, huge, massive derpy ears. Things. Yeah. So it's just all to do with the amount of heat. The amount of heat can lose across those surfaces.
Speaking of heat loss, I think it's camels. But I'm going to say camels, so correct me if I'm wrong. But camels have the ability to vomit up their stomachs to get the heat loss. And I have a theory that there's a scene where the Shai-Hulud, the giant worm, is like exposing that center part in its teeth, and I'm wondering if that was sort of like a heat loss thing. It was cooling itself down.
Could be venting.
Yeah.
Could potentially, seeing as the amount of energetic, like the metabolic heat they would have built up after sprinting after them, trying to, you know, catch some food.
Yeah.
I mean, I do believe they have to surface regularly to breathe. Like whales, you're not going to get that much oxygen underneath. And that would make the most sense. But yeah, if they're also surfacing because it's going to get really warm under there to just try and like let off heat at night. Yeah, they may actually have periods of like higher surface activity in the evenings.
And this is the last thing that we should touch on, is that if you're in a desert, being underground is a really good place to be. I mean, that's why you have so many burrowing species in deserts, because, and we haven't touched on this at all, deserts are fucking freezing in the middle of the night. Like, Cammy and I were lucky enough to be in the Sahara Desert at the end of 2019, and we were out in this camp, like, right in the middle of the desert, and we had many layers of clothing on, and it was still freezing.
That was, I mean, I was going to say that's something I appreciate about the movie, is them showing them, like, in the morning, you need to come inside, so we need to seal the house up so it keeps the cool air inside. We don't let all this boiling fucking desert air get inside. And it seemed like they were switching between imperial and metric units in the movie, because they mentioned at the spaceport that it's 90 degrees now. Is this 90 degrees Celsius or Fahrenheit? Because that's a hot day, or that is almost boiling water.
Yeah, maybe it's 90 degrees Celsius because they're in a city that's full of cement that just sucks in heat.
Could be.
Did love the gardener keeping those plants alive, and he's like, oh, should we get rid of them? And part of the reason why I felt the guy so like vehemently was like, no, we need to keep these trees, is he's like, this is my fucking job.
Where do you think I get my water? He's like sipping from the bucket when no one's looking.
Should we just get rid of these trees?
No.
Yeah.
Super important.
Get out of here, white boy. You don't know how it is here.
For the sandworms, the coolest fucking thing I got thinking about watching this movie was their movement through the sand. I mean, they seem to be swimming in it. They come up, they're able to surface on the top, they can move back down. We know that they usually travel deep and then they come to the surface when they need to. So trying to figure out how that works, because we've talked about burrowing species before and the problem with Earth being dirt is dirt. Generally speaking, if you fall from a high height, you don't want to land on top of it. It's a dense substance to move through. The exception to this being the concept of non-Newtonian fluids. So a non-Newtonian fluid is a fluid that does not follow by typical laws of viscosity. So basically constant viscosity independent of stress. If Sam gets beating on the water harder, it doesn't get firmer or thicker. It continues to be fucking water. There are substances, though, that go away from that. So their viscosity changes when they come under force. So the viscosity aspect that I want to talk about today, because there's a whole bunch of different non-Newtonian fluids, and as we've discussed before on this podcast, physics is my weakest subject. Shear thinning, or pseudoplastic, is apparent viscosity decreases with increased stress. And really cool, one of the best examples of this is quicksand. So quicksand is a non-Newtonian fluid. Certain animals are capable of walking on top of the quicksand because it's actually dense enough to support them, while other larger animals fall. And the saturated sediment basically appears quite solid until a sudden change in pressure or shock initiates liquefaction. This causes the sand to form a suspension and lose strength. The cushioning of water gives quicksand and other liquefied sediments this spongy fluid-like texture so that objects that sit in the sand sink to the level at which the weight of the object is equal to the weight of the displaced soil-water mixture, and the submerged objects float due to their buoyancy. If this sand is made up in such a way that it's basically following by non-Newtonian physics, and smaller objects are able to move along the surface typically, but a large organism like the worm basically is floating along in this, it could have properties that act like water to the sandworm, theoretically. Which would be fucking cool, because it means it's not typical sand. It's got some sort of other element that's in it that's allowing it to exhibit these properties.
That is super cool, but Dave, I'm sorry to have to
really
destroy this, because I really, really like this idea. But this basically means that if the sandworms don't constantly keep moving and they stop for a second, even a little bit under the sand, they're going to be crushed instantly by all that pressure.
But it's their force that's acting on it. It's their weight. So this is, if you've ever watched the non-Newtonian fluid of the guy who's like gently moving his hand through, but when then he goes like smashing on it, it thickens. So theoretically, their force and buoyancy is going to act like quicksand. The quicksand doesn't become firmer or harder when I'm laying in it. I exhibit buoyancy if I'm there. I'm just displacing it around me. So they're probably going to have adaptations or mechanisms to move through this. Again, I'm sure a physicist could come along and destroy this 5,000 ways. But this is the closest I can get to just a sand that isn't sand, but it's acting in such a way that it would allow these giant organisms, just through the sheer nature of their mass, to cause it to act in a non-Newtonian manner.
I mean, there are some species of shark that can never stop moving.
Yeah. Maybe the sandworms aren't. Maybe they are moving all the time. Maybe that's why it's better for them to come up and filter feed without swallowing. They're just pulling it through because they don't want to stop.
Yeah.
Explain why they're so pissed off when the Fremen pulls a scale off them. They're like, fuck off. It's hot out here, you asshole.
I didn't mention them getting sunburned in the book, don't they?
They will. They can cook them. They can kill them if they keep them up too long.
Mm-hmm. Sharks are hunters and predators. They never stop swimming. In fact, if a shark stops swimming, it will die. If a shark goes backwards, it will die. Think like a shark, act like a shark, and behave like a shark.
So, just before we finish up with the science for this week, the last thing I want to talk about is desertification, which is a very real phenomena that has been affecting our planet ever since we started changing the world around us, and hasn't been helped along by...
Is this the problem involving not enough ice cream trucks?
Yeah, I was going to say there's not enough cakes.
Desertification? No, desertification would indicate an increase in ice cream trucks.
Oh, this sounds good. This sounds great. Thank okay, goodness. Good.
Yeah, this neighborhood has been desertified. It's just, you know.
Man, we grew up in neighborhoods of just old people, so that the desertification never happened to us because the ice cream truck never came by.
It's just a truck full of Werther's originals.
No, they had stocks every single house.
Adam.
Okay.
Adam, anywhere you go, it's desertification because you bring that cake.
Sorry, Sam.
Right.
Gross. desertification is basically land degradation in dry land areas. So like I said before, arid, semi-arid, dry subhuman areas. They're home to 3 billion people, which is a massive fucking chunk of this planet. And the main causes are our extending of croplands, ruining natural biodiversity, fragmentation of natural habitat, of course, pollution. And in the last two decades, naturally, climate change has played a huge part in this. And what it results in is less water, feedback cycle where because you've got less water, you get less native plant life that's able to persist. Things like soil being looser, so infrastructure crumbling as well. And just life becoming a lot harder, not only for the flora and fauna that normally belong in that area, but also for the people. Desertification is currently triggering and will trigger in the future mass migrations of people into other parts of the world. It's going to be a huge problem. And it's not people like us who live in relatively affluent and, apart from Adam at the moment, areas that are very far from these kind of places. But there are massive amounts of people living in the sub-Sahara and those parts of the world throughout Asia, throughout Africa, who are going to be hit really hard by this sort of stuff. And there are things we can do about it. It comes down to what we've spoken about before. Yes, population growth in some of these areas is a big problem because it places pressure on natural resources that are already under a lot of strain. But overconsumption is really what drives climate change a lot more than overpopulation.
Yeah.
And so if you want to help out, it comes down to, you know, stuff we talked about before. Buy used if you can, contribute to a circular economy. Eat less meat. As we always say, you don't have to go vegan. You don't have to go vegetarian. If the whole world just ate less meat, you know, twice or three times a week, we'd be in a really good position. Don't stigmatize having hand-me-downs or buying used or anything like that. And yeah, if you want to contribute to charities that plant trees, empower women in areas. Empowering women is a really helpful way to limit population growth and increase the overall education of a population. Find charities that do that sort of stuff. And yeah, because it makes a huge difference not only to the lives of people in these areas, but in 20 years, if you've got kids or if you'll be alive in 20 years, which judging by our listener statistics, most of you will be, it's going to make a huge difference to your life as well. So, yeah.
Change your search engine from Google to Ecosia, because they plant trees for every search that you make.
I love Ecosia.
And look, if we all make moderate changes now, it's going to stop us having to make extreme changes in 10, 15 years' time.
And I'll jump on that, too, of saying I'm a firm believer in that most of the global warming problems are directly from corporations.
Yeah.
but, you know, at least here, you know, in America, everything is capitalist. And so we do have a certain amount of impact on those corporations. Yeah. I mean, if you look at vegan plant-based products, when you were vegan in the 70s, all you had to eat was TVP, which is textured vegetable protein. Now we have everything from bratwurst to chicken to burgers to steaks. They have a Thanksgiving roast, all plant-based, but that's thanks to consumers buying more of those things and then marketing having to listen to those needs and wanting to make money and producing that, right? Yeah. They don't give a shit about the planet. They just care about making money. So our choices can impact the direction in which they make those monetary dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. And voting as well. Use your vote to think about climate change issues. We won't tell you who to vote for. We will just tell you, look into what the party that you're thinking of voting for's environmental policies are.
Don't vote for Tiger King. I'll say don't vote for Tiger King, but like...
The purpose of this video today is to let you know who I am. I have tried drugs through the younger years of my life. I am broke as shit. I have a judgment against me from some bitch down there in Florida. I am now stepping my foot in the ring to run for president.
Now, I didn't really have too much for a story section this week, but I think I wanted to use my time to address sort of some problem-solving scenes. For those of you who have not read the books and are just watching the movie, you might have thought, well, hang on, I don't understand this. So the worms, as we have said in this pod, are responsible for the spice. So you might think, well, why are these big carnivorous machine-eating worms just allowed to live when you could bomb the shit out of them? So they don't destroy the worms because they produce the spice. So it's very necessary to keep those worms alive. I think in the books too, they say that they tried to kill them.
You can't.
They're basically indestructible.
And you can't. So they don't address that in the movie. So I just wanted to sort of put that out there. The coffee scene. Sorry, go ahead, Sam.
I don't know. There are probably more discerning viewers than me, but I wasn't sitting there wondering.
You just don't get
She's answering Sam. Other people's questions, Sam. It's not always about you.
Yes, it is. This is called Sam-O-Matica Animalia, okay?
Sam-O-Matica.
Wait, guys, I'm looking it up. Fuck, he changed the title. He did it.
No, but I am actually interested in this. I'll keep it to myself from now on, but I want to see what, you know, what you lot thought a mere mortal couldn't have understood from these books, from these films.
No, it's good. It's I'm good interested perspective.
To hear this. I was more of like they didn't dive into the full explanation is okay. Where I'm coming from.
Okay. Fucking so, snobs. What?
This one is a little bit more self-explanatory, but yeah. Just in case you didn't catch it. Everyone's been talking about the coffee scene and how fucking disgusting it is. Again, that is because moisture is very valuable. So everything is made from the recollected moisture that humans produce because there is no real other water source.
Yeah, I was wondering, I actually was going to ask Dave if that was a process that got explained in the later books because Libby and I have only read the first two, but if I just remember reading the first book and them talking about the coffee services and having coffee and spiced coffee because it happens like all the fucking times in the book. And if it's been made by people spitting in a fucking cup, I never want to drink coffee again. I love coffee.
I thought that was a really cool scene though. Like I thought that was a really kind of organic world building scene of like, this is the lengths people go to. This is what, you know, we
For sure.
have to do to
get And I appreciated coffee. I appreciated that they did multiple people as it wasn't just one guy contributing all of his water with his moisture. Yeah. So it's a three blend coffee. Yeah.
Can I ask at this point, are there any other uses of urine that are touched on in the books?
Not to my knowledge.
No, but there is a super cool water currency that I'm hoping they get into in the next movie that has to do with water is money. So the reason they're dragging away the body at the end is because that water belongs to Paul. It's then kept inside of like these big tanks, these vaults that they have. And then you actually have like allocated amounts of like, this is Paul's water. Like you have that water to like pull in.
They give you tokens that say like how much you have.
Yeah, that you use.
They do touch on that in the movie, the concept of like, we should, you know, kill these people and use their bodies.
Yeah, but water is currency. Like it becomes like the underlying value of like gold sort of underlies the US currency. In this situation, water is that like underlying glue that holds it together.
A touching scene with the Jameis fight and then doing the coffee service after. In the book, there's a little like ritualistic scene they do of saying like, whenever someone is killed, they say, this person was my friend, blah, blah, blah. They would want me to have that. And they take something of that person's. And Paul gets Jameis's coffee service. So I'm wondering if that was meant to be a little nod to that scene in the book of this little coffee percolator thing was Jameis's. Now they're using it to make coffee for Paul.
Probably. I watched this movie with my brother-in-law, and when that Jameis scene happened, I was laughing because, first of all, it kind of looks like he's not fully dead when they're started, like, wrapping him up. Like, they're, like, closing his eyes, and he's, like, fighting it. And then the guy's wrapping him in the tarp, and I was doing voices. I was like, oh, man, we're going to get so much fucking coffee out of this. Just, like, wrapping him up. And he's like, hey, motherfuckers, I'm not dead yet. So another quick thing I wanted to talk about was the sword fighting versus bombs. I called my dad, who's read the books when he was a youngster, and he was like, you know, one thing I didn't quite understand is why do they have all these super big explosive weapons and then they have fucking sword fights? He said he actually looked it up, and the answer is that those shields that they wear, you see the glowing shields, when they are hit by those weapons, they create an atomic explosion. So it would be super dangerous for anybody in the area to, like, it would just destroy everything. So defeating the purpose of trying to conquer an area.
I should just point out, because while we're talking about the Shields, if nobody's seen the 1980s
fucking
version,
blocks.
Go and look up what the Shields look like in that movie. It is... It's absurd. It is absolutely absurd, but it's also hilarious, so please go and check it out.
The last thing scene that I wanted to talk about, because it definitely is the scene that stood out to me the most, and I didn't look this up. I have no idea the director's intent with this scene. This is just my own personal reasoning that I created for me to be able to watch this scene and not feel completely icky, was the creepy scene with Jessica and Paul changing into their still suits. And yep, everybody knows the one I'm talking about, where they're like kind of weirdly sexually watching each other.
What the fuck was that?
So the reason, here's the reasoning I came up with to be able to sort of digest the scene and it be okay, is in the book especially, you get a lot more of Paul being a very young boy. And I think they do a good job in the movie of expressing that. You know, he's doing a lot of little kiddish things, like running up to see Duncan and like hugging on him just like a kid would. Things like that. And I think that scene, at least in my mind, is where the director made the choice to say, okay, Jessica is recognizing that her son is now a man. And now that there's like a weird, there's a privacy that needs to occur because he is no longer a boy.
Yeah.
And that's how I explain that scene. It doesn't make it any less creepy, but at least it removes some of the like weird sexuality from it. It's more about a mom recognizing her son becoming, or her boy becoming a man. So that's how I explained that scene. I don't know what the intent was with the director. That's just Libby's explanation.
Oh my God!
What the hell have you done, Fry? It's impossible. I mean, if she's my grandmother, who's my grandfather? You are!
Do we feel bad for the monsters in the movie?
Yes.
The monsters and the Fremen, yes.
Yeah. I feel bad for actual cannibal Shahi Lud in ways I will never feel bad for actual cannibal Shia LaBeouf.
Yes.
Especially, like, because at the end of the movie, until you lot said it, I had thought that there was some sort of, you know, mutualistic relationship between the Fremen and the Shahi Lud, but now I know that they're just like causing skin irritation to ride them. That's not fun.
No, yeah. And also taking a shit ton of their food away all the time. No wonder they're eating people, because if you're pumping out all the spice, they gotta get external food somewhere else. Like, yeah, fucking throw a couple more in.
Okay, well, would we recommend this movie?
Yes!
100%.
Yes. And the original, I know Sam hated it, but I still like it.
No, you cannot recommend the original.
I like the original.
Get fucked. Yeah,
no, I recommend the books. I recommend the original. I recommend this movie. Fucking love Dune.
You are crazy in ways that I can't describe right now.
I hate when mom and dad fight.
Yeah, me too.
The voiceovers are the most annoying. It's not even a voiceover. You hear what they're thinking, and it is... Oh, it's... How can you defend this movie?
No, I still liked it.
Sting?
Yeah, Sting is great.
As a weird naked boy.
I recommend this movie. I think if you're going to read the books, be prepared. They're very dense.
Yeah. I recommend this movie, as with all Denis Villeneuve movies, apart from Arrival. If you're at home and you've got, like, I don't know, Pokemon Go or Candy Crush on the go at the same time. Because, man, there are just some shots that... Oh, he loves to linger. He loves to linger longer.
Next week?
Yeah.
What are we doing next week?
Next week, we are going to dance magic dance with Labyrinth.
Oh, yes!
Oh my God, are we really?
We are.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Watch that then.
Yes.
See, Sam's like, oh, I have to watch it. And I'm like, oh, I have to watch this again. Yeah.
It's so good.
I never watched the whole thing.
Oh, I watch Labyrinth like once a year.
It's so fun.
Bowie's in space.
Bowie's in space.
Would you like to borrow my jumper, Bowie?
Bye-bye.
We are House Atreides. There is no call we do not answer. There is no faith that we betray.
Smile, Gurney.
I am smiling.
The Emperor asks us to bring peace to Arrakis. House Atreides accepts!
I know you. There's only a way thing in my mind.
You need to face your fears.
Come with me. You need to be ready. You've never met Harkonnens before. They're not human, they're brutal.
The Duke's son sees too much.
This is why, Dune. Kill them all.